Hello, listeners. Welcome to season two of Where They Are Now and Where We Will Follow. Today's special guest is Christopher Adamek, an Elon Biochemistry 2020 alum. Mr. Adamek has made great waves not only at Elon, but also in the greater scientific community. Mr. Adamek, would you like to introduce yourself?
My name is Christopher Adamek. I graduated in 2020 with a major in biochemistry and one course short of a theater arts minor. And I'm currently working at Moderna as a senior research associate for nucleic acid technology.
Thank you so much, Mr. Adamek, for letting me interview you. Can you talk to us about your current career and what you've done to progress in it?
Yeah, so I started in 2020. I think June of 2020, I immediately graduated Elon after that 5-month COVID shutdown through Zoom University. Immediately got back to Massachusetts, which is home for me. So I was very fortunate to kind of be living at home and commuting to work. Manufacturing, started off there, was dean of manufacturing. So we were the 32 some odd people working to manufacture the large amounts of COVID DNA. That was the direct precursor to the COVID RNA. So we were working on that, did that for about a year. While I was there, I learned a lot from some pretty impressive people, both within my team as well as direct supervisors, people who were the subject matter experts in areas. If ever there was a problem, they got to know my name pretty quickly because I called them up and I said, let's go. We got a problem, help us resolve it. And they immediately fixed it, which was awesome. Stepped into the realm of manufacturing investigations. I really enjoyed some aspects of manufacturing. There were some that I did not like. I didn't like how mundane it felt. I liked it at the time because I needed something to do to occupy myself from talking with family. So immediately finding a place to just get away for 8 hours a day or 10 hours a day, depending on what shift I was doing. That was very nice. So then I went into manufacturing investigations where if ever there was a problem on the floor, anything from a possibility of product not meeting a certain specification, or if there was a room that wasn't cleaned properly, we'd be the people who were contacted and we had to figure out impact to product, if there is impact to product, and then try to figure out why it happened and make sure it doesn't happen again. So I did that for about a year and a half. And then a lot of imposter syndrome seeped into my life while I was in that role. And then I stepped into senior research associate position over nucleic acid tech. And then this team is basically platform research. Moderna has always been a platform research company. We've always tried to figure out ways to improve RNA in certain cells, in certain tissue. So basically everything we do on this team now, if it doesn't directly affect the outcome or the goal of the experiment, we can definitely find a different project that it could assist with, which is really cool. It feels very much like leaving an orange near an open windowsill and then penicillin shows up. You're like, whoa. It feels very similar like that. If you fail, it's not a failure. If you fail, it could be moved into a different pipeline altogether. And that's really exciting. That's what research should be. And that's what it feels like right now. Yeah.
You've talked a lot about imposter syndrome. Can you expand upon what it made you feel like, adversities you faced from it, and what you've learned coming out on the other end?
I mean, my story is unfortunately more failure oriented because I couldn't deal with it for very much longer. So Phoenix flop story right here, I guess. But from it, I feel like I've made the right decision coming out of it. But I truly felt remarkably relied upon when I was in that role of investigations. A lot of that comes from just how important the sciences at Elon prioritize rhetoric and argument in your writing. Remove bias and just talk about the data. The data should speak for itself. There doesn't need to be any fluff. Remove all of those adverbs. That's not scientific at all. And I did a pretty decent job at it. So I hit the ground running, and there are people who were in investigations for years longer than I have. And I was someone people relied on to write a strong, robust investigation. And it felt great initially, but then the deeper and more complicated investigations I was handed, I began to feel like, hold on, what is going on? They see something in me that I don't see in myself. And it really got to me. And I had to step away. It was extremely stressful. My work phone was constantly on me. I was working an insane amount of hours just to kind of keep my head above water. And I did what was best for me, which was stepping back and reassessing and determining what I really wanted in that moment was to return to science. I really liked the lab feeling. I really liked not all of the gowning I had to wear in manufacturing, but I really enjoyed stepping into the lab and just getting something done and getting my hands dirty, subjectively dirty. The samples weren't getting dirty, I promise, but I just wanted to get back into the lab, and that's what research was. And I applied, and within about 2 months, I moved from investigations to research.
Yeah, and I think it's also important to acknowledge that you are very young. Like you're still in your 20s
Yeah.
and you graduated, and so many people would not be able to step into that role and climb to the height that you climbed to.
Thank
And
you.
like you were under so much stress. And to step back and acknowledge, like, I need space to breathe is not only the healthiest thing for you, but also your career. To tie into the next question, so how did the curriculum and hands-on laboratory experiences at Elon, which you had kind of touch prepare you for technical aspects of your role?
There are so many direct applications of laboratory techniques. And I think, there's one thing in the lab, which is, can we get students to understand what a meniscus is, which is very elementary. But also, laboratory techniques, you need to teach them, and you need to teach them correctly. So every single lab, everything from Gen Chem all the way up to instrumental chemical analysis or quantitative chemical analysis labs, I am not lying when I say puts me light years ahead of everybody else in that laboratory. Elon does prioritize the hands-on experience. And I don't know if the tours are still going on in McMichael. Is that still happening? Like the separate science tours? No. So back when I was a student, I was a tour guide for one day. During this tour guide adventure, I was also pursuing an EMTB degree because I was like, I need patient contact hours. I need a way to do that. And I thought it was by being an EMT. And my EMT class met on Saturdays. And in order to be a tour guide, you needed to have your Saturdays open for some student retention events, to which I said, interesting, I have an academic commitment. And they gave me an ultimatum. They said, either you're a tour guide or you're not. And I said, okay, I'm gonna pursue the class that I'm paying for. Thank you. Basically, this got back up to some professors, and I know this is something I will be talking about later, but professors had my back, which was awesome. And we decided to introduce some sort of separate tour for more science interested students. So we brought them into McMichael and we took them through the labs. And something that professor said, which I 100% agree with, is we want students to play with our instruments. We want students to fail on the instruments. We want students to learn on the instruments. So I walked into that lab when I was a research associate, and I knew how to work my way around an HPLC, how to work my way around just everything in the lab. You learn how to MacGyver pretty quickly in the Elon labs. It was just extremely important to have that experience. Everything that you learn, you might not realize in the moment if this is important. But there are some people who don't know how to use a pipette, and I'm like, come on now. We gotta move forward, folks. This is basic technique. Undergraduate lab or even graduate lab, you learn quickly and then you're able to apply it extremely well. And I feel like Elon did a phenomenal job at making us work with instruments.
And expanding on that, were there any specific courses or subjects within biochem that you found particularly challenging or rewarding? And how did it shape your perspective on the field you're in now?
There were so many labs that were so important. The microbiology lab that Dr. Izzo led, that was extremely important. Aseptic technique, it is very important in the biotech field. And even though it was a classroom setting, you had to understand that basically everything you were doing was contaminating a sample. So be better at your movements, be better at your technique. That was a very important one. Quantitative chemical analysis. That first lab, I don't know if Dr. Claire is still doing the same lab style, and I don't want to take away the shock and awe of that first lab, but we were running an experiment and we were using UV vis to determine analyte in a sample. And it would absorb wonderfully at 260. However, there was something else in solution that also absorbed at that wavelength or similar wavelength. And we were getting cross-contamination is the wrong word, but we basically were not getting the correct assessment of our analyte. And it took us about 3.5 hours. And then Dr. Claire was like, "Isn't that interesting? Isn't that interesting? You should know what you're testing. Isn't that interesting?" But it was designed so that you would fail. And I enjoy that. And I don't know if he meant to design it that way. So that's me, I guess, projecting what I thought the lab takeaway was. But that lab was, I'm giving you something that seems simple on paper. Assess it and tell me why your data looks the way that it does. And it gave me a whole new perspective on truly what a blank is if you're trying to be extremely analytical, how to be extremely specific in measurements. It was awesome. And I loved it so much, I pursued instrumental chemical analysis with Dr. Seinerth. However, that was during COVID, so we weren't really able to have that true lab experience. I think the last lab that we were supposed to do was we were basically going to be sampling certain dollar bills for a certain substance. So he was like, "Somebody bring in a 20, somebody bring in 100, I'll bring in the singles." Unfortunately, we weren't able to run that lab. It would have been really interesting, but we were not able to do that lab. But those labs were truly the most applicable to what I'm doing now.
That's really great. And I know that also Elon encourages experiential learning through internships or co-op programs or study abroad. Did you do any of those? I know you talked about EMTB, but any other?
Yeah, I did not do an internship. I think I did every other ELR. I did a J term study abroad or study away. I went to Hawaii for that semester. It was, I think people like to make the joke of like, "Oh, study abroad in Hawaii, nice." But it was genuinely one of the most life-changing experiences I've been on, not only because of the intercontinental ballistic missile threat that we received that morning in 2018, which I'm still teasing out with my therapist about. However, it was also the stories and how impactful, how many people we were talking with, and they said, "This is so important to us." And it was a culture ELR, I believe, and it was remarkably important. I was really happy about my final paper that I wrote for that course. I had some amazing professors on that trip. It was, oh God, Dr. Pugh, who no longer teaches there. I believe he retired in 2020. And then Dr. Vandermeer-Peeler, who's from psychology, I believe she's still there. And she was also just remarkably intelligent with everything that she was teaching us throughout the entire semester. But that's what I did my study abroad. I wanted to do a semester abroad. It definitely, I put those my own blinders on. I put my own barriers up. I was very in my head and I didn't take a semester, although I really wanted to. And Sophie Ehrlich did an amazing job explaining on a previous podcast how to triage that feeling. But I put my own barriers up. I definitely wanted to go abroad, but I couldn't.
I was going to ask too, you talked about patient contact hours. So were you originally planning to go to med school?
Yes, med school was ruled out when I was a sophomore. But I definitely entered with the whole pre-med idea in my head. I quickly dropped that after 2 years, and then I decided maybe PA school, and that lasted up until junior spring, where I failed my practical for EMTs. That was an eventful moment altogether. I remember crying during one practical. It was the trauma practical, and the two paramedics were sitting back in their chairs and they were describing the scene, and they're very nonchalant about, "You arrive and there was a patient that just flew out of the windshield. You see their leg is bent in a certain way. Begin." And I was just so overwhelmed at that moment, and I just started to cry. And I was like, "Is the scene safe?" And they were just like, "All right, go, go, go. You're not passing this." And that was immediately shut down. I definitely thought I could do patient contact, so I tried to find other ways to get there. So I volunteered at a PT clinic, outpatient PT, and I learned quickly that summer that I really don't like dealing with patients. I am very, I would say I'm a germaphobe, and dealing with people who are just like, "Can you touch my extremely sweaty leg?" And I'm like, "I'm okay. I'm okay. This is really great. I'm okay." But now I'm kind of in a field where I can still kind of hold on to that scientific love for medicines and therapeutics, but be very far away from the clinic. Which I really enjoy. So I still feel like I am adding to the overall help and support of medical professionals, but from a very far away location.
No, I agree. You totally are. I mean, vaccinations are so important and research is so important in the medical community. And every scientist plays a role, even if they think that they don't. So I definitely think you are. And you were a member of OSTEM. Could you elaborate on this organization, the significance of it to you personally, and also the importance to Elon's scientific community?
So I identify as queer. I really stepped into my kind of renaissance of self-identity my freshman year. I was able to kind of renew myself, getting away from home. And I really did find some lifelong friends and some really great support as soon as I stepped foot on Elon's campus that fall semester. And I ultimately came into contact with another great, phenomenal human, Sydney Thornton. I believe we met very early on. I want to say freshman or sophomore year, but our friendship really didn't bloom until I think organic, where misery is so sewn into the class, you begin to find some phenomenal friends who will pull you out of those trenches. Sydney met somebody when she was another student who was a biochem major who pursued a full semester abroad. She did semester at sea. She met a student on the massive cruise ship that they repurpose into classrooms from another university. I don't know where, but that student that she was talking with mentioned they brought an organization called OSTEM onto their campus, and she learned more about it, and she knew that this needed to be brought to Elon's campus. So Sydney and I began talking about it. And then Sydney said, "I want this to happen." And I was like, "All right, let's go." So we found three great professors, Dr. Blackman, Dr. Seinerth, and then Libby from the library. She's an archivist. She's awesome. She's the reason, not one of the bigger reasons why this organization's on campus. OSTEM is there to cultivate an environment for LGBTQIA identifying students who are in STEM. One of the most amazing quotes I remember from a former director of the GLC, Matthew Antonio Bosch, he always referred to LGBTQIA communities. He always made it plural. And he said, "There's not just one gay community, there are many gay communities." OSTEM is just another GLC. GLC is a phenomenal, massive organization we have on campus, and it is so important to have that. And it's great that Mosley was renovated to make it more forward-facing. OSTEM is just another GLC. It's just another place to have a community within the communities of LGBTQIA peoples to just affirm your existence and your presence. And that was really important. And Sydney said, "If I had this when I was a first year, I would be so much more advanced psychologically, accepting of myself." And I agree with her. I'd be so much happier if I had this organization when I was a first year. And I'm just happy to know that it is still kicking and it's still around and it's still doing well. We brought it on during 2020, and we were like, "We really hope this doesn't die." And we had some great professors who were there. We had some great underclassmen, some juniors, sophomores, first years who quite literally carried the torch forward. And it is great to see that it's still doing its job on campus, which is making sure that they know that we're here. And it's such an important organization. I I'm so happy that Sydney met this human on a cruise ship during semester at sea and said, we need this on campus. So without her, this organization wouldn't be here.
And often as children, we dream of careers to be a doctor or an astronaut. If you were to explain your career to a younger audience in hopes that your path became their passion, what would you talk about?
That's a good question. When I was younger, I wanted to be Carl Sagan. I remember I was in a Montessori school for, I believe, just for first grade. I don't know if they do the same thing at every Montessori school, but there was like a dress up as who you want to be. And it was my, I just wanted to be Carl Sagan. I enjoyed the cosmos when I was growing up. I mean, it's very easy for that to be in a picture book, and then for there to be like a couple scientific words on there, like star or nebula, and you're like, I've learned today. So that was very awesome as a young one growing up and learning about science through pictures and then some lovely glossary terms. But I think right now, if I were to explain it to a young one in Montessori, I love analogies, so I'm going to do this one. Do you remember the game Blob Tag growing up? Okay, here's what I'm thinking. I think the best way to explain vaccination and then kind of the immunization of vaccines is if you were to play blob tag and you give, let's say we have 20 students who are playing in the gymnasium, and you have one person who starts as it, or one person who has a sickness or a virus. And then let's say you give two students, without any other student knowing, these little cards that say, uh-uh, can't get me. Or if you tag me, you have to tag me twice in order for you to like become a blob. Imagine what would happen if you grew that from two students to four students to six to eight, 10, 12. It's going to be a lot harder for that one student to tag everybody at the gymnasium. And that is vaccination on the simplest terms. There are people who do get vaccinated and then get sick. I understand that story. But there's also the story of imagine getting sick, not being vaccinated, and getting more sick. It's a compiling effect. And I think for you and I, it's a very easy conversation to have, even just at a very high bird's eye view about vaccination. But trying to convince somebody, oh, there are side effects of the vaccine. The conversations you have with people, you need to weigh the odds. If you don't want to get vaccinated, that is your prerogative. You might get extremely sick and reap those repercussions of excusing yourself from a vaccine. If you are to get vaccinated, the side effects of maybe feeling a wee bit sick for 24 hours, I would do that over the 5 days of absolute disgust I got from COVID. It was not fun. Everything smelled like Starbursts. Everything tasted like Starbursts. If you like that, then I guess that's a good thumbs up for getting COVID, but it is not fun. I think the best way to explain that to a kid is playing blob tag. I think that's a really fun little example.
That's a great way to explain it too. And I think in knowing that and telling them like you have helped in, manufacturing and research and you know what I mean? You could be like, I was this bigger player to make sure the blob tag went on. Like I'm the referee. Like I
Absolutely.
allow things to go on. And something else that I was going to ask on top of that was how your experience with vaccines and spike vax and everything contributed to your understanding of RNA science, because I know that RNA science, I mean, it's been around for a long time. However, like it's mostly groundbreaking now with COVID and the COVID vaccine too. So just an expansion of that.
Spikevax using its full government name. I like that. I learned so much about RNA manufacturing, RNA design, RNA biotech when I was in manufacturing for 2.5 years. And then I learned so much more about just RNA, the molecule, when I was now in research. It has been around for a very, very, very long time. However, when you look at it, kind of the central dogma of things, everything starts at the DNA level. And now DNA molecules are so So cheap with massive air quotes. I say so cheap from a biotech background where we're like, oh, that's 30,000, swipe the card. But like so cheap DNA. RNA oligos are extremely expensive. I misplaced somewhere around $30,000 worth of RNA, and it was about 5 mils of RNA. And I was ripping apart my freezer trying to find it. It was in my fridge. It was just regardless, RNA is new, but it is still expensive, and it's still very much novel. And I work on an amazing team, which is under the umbrella of RNA science, which is very topical to the question you've just asked. And our goal is how can we make the best RNA for this therapeutic area? So we're modifying everything in the RNA, and we're going bit by bit, we're going oligo by oligo. It is remarkably fascinating. And I remember in undergrad, I did not like genetics all too much. I was like, I don't really care about it. Introns, exons, sure. I think my favorite part is my initials are CGA, and everyone in RNA science is like, oh, this is the field for you. And I'm just like, sure. They're like, your initials are in everything, RNA, DNA. And I go, awesome. I was like, yeah, it's pretty cool. I've learned so much in the span of just a year, specifically in research. The papers that they go through at such an extremely quick rate. And while we're working on one project, there's somebody else that just posed another question and it's coming down the pipeline. And our manager does a phenomenal job at explaining, all right, you're making this RNA. You might be wondering, what is it for? This is what it's for. So RNAs that purposefully do one thing, it's very difficult to figure out what I can and can't explain. So I'm using a lot of vague terms right now. I apologize. It's like Spark Notes. This is how Spark Notes should be created. So you encourage students to read a book. This person said something like this. However, like you want some RNA to do a certain effect in one cell and a different RNA to do a different effect in another cell. And sometimes it works. We're like, awesome, let's keep going down that trail. It's very awesome. I'm on the process side of things. So what can we do to make the process, the turnaround time, what can we do to shorten that? So I enjoy that. I enjoy the purification techniques. I enjoy the manufacturing techniques. I enjoy the instrumentation. I love instrumentation. Anybody that says machine in my lab, I go instrument. And they go, why? And I say, in the great words of Dr. Seinerth, you have to learn to play that instrument. You don't just click go. So yes, I'm carrying that baton forward. But I've learned, I've shocked myself with how much I've been able to learn in this space. 100%.
And you've talked about a couple of professors, but can you talk about your most impactful professors?
I just because Dr. Sanders right now in the forefront of my thoughts right now, as well as OSTEM from earlier. I remember when I was a first year, I was entering spring semester and I registered for a lab with a professor who I had in the previous semester. I said, I really want this. This professor is wild. She's crazy. She makes the 5:30 to 8:30 p.m. labs exciting. And I really wanted her. And then during the class registration, it turned from her name to just staff. And then as soon as I got my schedule, it gave me a different name. And I was like, whoa, what is this? Little freshman Chris didn't know there was a lot of things happening in the background. So I went to the chair of the chem department at the time, and that was Dr. Seinerth. And I had no clue who he was. I just know he was the chair. What does the chair mean? It's who is that? So I walk into the chem suite and I was intimidated. Because there were all of these upperclassmen who were talking like, oh, the nucleophilic addition, oh, and I'm just like, oh, I just know there's carbon. I walk into Dr. Seinerth's office extremely nervous for this extremely hulking character to be like, no, I'm denying access to your request of switching labs. And I walk in, and there he is at his desk, and there's a massive pride flag hanging behind him. And I just immediately felt a massive weight get lifted off my shoulders. And I was like, wow, this is visibility. This is nice. And I walked in, and instead of having the fear of whatever that was looming above my head, implicit bias kind of that went out the door. And I was able to have that conversation with him and kind of have a more professional conversation with him, as opposed to something where it had been very defensive and very uncomfortable for me. And that was extremely important. It's not very classroom centric, but it was very important to have that visibility. And the professors have done such an amazing job over my 4 years at stepping up and being present in those spaces, especially with, I think, a lot of the STEM students who are pushing on them, saying like, oh, come to my event. Oh, come to my sport event. And they show up, and that is awesome. It was very nice to have that from the get-go, from my first year there, to see that there has already been some legwork from professors. That was amazing. Really remarkable. I have so many professors that I want to give a shout out to, which is so painful, because I'm going to name so many of them, but I'll forget one. And then that one professor is going to be like, Chris. But just every professor that I was able to talk with, so impactful on where I am now. Very helpful and formative conversations, as well as ones that kind of not abrasively, but kind of tore me down to my core and made me reassess in the moment, which was extremely beneficial. Probably not in the moment I was thinking like, how dare they think so low of me? But no, they're there to advise you. They're there to be your professors. They're there to make you a better person. You're paying thousands of dollars for school. They're gonna do their job. And they did it phenomenally well. There were so many professors in like other areas outside of science that I enjoyed as well. I had one phenomenal public speaking professor. Blanking on her name, and that's making me a horrible human right now, but truly revolutionized what it meant to kind of hold a conversation in a public forum. It helped me with senior seminar. It was remarkably important for senior seminar. However, that final presentation, there was somebody who kept tally of how many times I opened and closed my water bottle without taking a drink from it. And they were like, were you thirsty or were you agitated? And I was like, I must have not been thirsty if I was opening and closing my water bottle that many times. But truly some remarkable professors that I will remember. Unfortunately, not all of their names, but kind of the impact they've made throughout my journey at Edlon.
And if you had one thing you wish you knew before stepping out into the workforce, what would it be?
How to do my taxes correctly. It's a joke, but I accidentally said that I was head of household, thinking like, yeah, I'm a single person living in an apartment, so I am the head of the household, not realizing that's for like people with children. And so that was a fun tax return statement. Honestly, out of just how difficult it is, and I think COVID was a large part of it, but how difficult it is to maintain some sort of community after you leave an extremely intimate setting that is college. I've lived in the suburbs since 2020. The apartment complexes are very siloing. They try to do things like come and meet your neighbor, and I'm not there for it. But just how awesome it was to wake up every day with three people that I wanted to see every day of my life at college. And we all went through the grocery store COVID craziness together. You can only have, I think, two chicken cutlets per household, and we're just like, hide the third one. Having that community and having so many resources readily available, it's a massive transition. We do a phenomenal job with welcoming new students to our campus. I was very proud of being a part of that. New student orientation and transfer student orientation and national student orientation. I loved it. They don't talk about that transition out of college. It was tough. It's still taking me time to kind of feel like I have a space, like I have a group of people. And I think I'm doing a decent job maintaining that contact, but that is a different thing altogether. So prioritize finding that space for you, or finding those people to make you the person you want to be. That was the toughest thing for me, 100%.
Thank you, Mr. Adamek, for letting me interview you. And thank you, listeners, to listening to Where They Are Now and Where We Will Follow.